You present.
Please proceed. Good morning, everyone. The first case on calendar today is case number 61902, Jones versus Nevada Commission on Judicial Discipline. Mr. Jimerson, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please do.
May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, members of the Nevada Supreme Court. I have the privilege this morning to spend a few minutes with you to explain and ask you to remedy an outrageous set of circumstances and decisions made by an esteemed commission, the Judicial Discipline Commission, that has gone awry over the last 20 years since the Thorpe pronouncements in Whitehead that culminated in its final decision, Whitehead 4, in 1996. I begin my premise by suggesting to you that the Judicial Discipline Commission has, since 1996, gone astray from the directives that the Nevada legislature has set forth under NRS 1.4, beginning with 1.4663, and has, over the last 20 years, continued to deviate from the mandatory, non-discretionary requirements of that statute. In short, the JDC does not follow the law. And how do we know that? They tell you so. At page 12 of the reply brief, and in the affidavit of the previous executive director, Mr. Sarnowski, he tells you, and I know it will be a surprise to you, that Chief Justice Pickering, if a complaint is filed against you during an investigation, you have no due process rights. Justice Gibbons, you have no due process rights. Justice Douglas, you have no due process rights during the investigative phase of a complaint before the JDC. In the face of NRS 1.4663, we begin with this. One, the selection of an investigator who is not independent, and but who is related to the former executive director's legal assistant. Number two, 1.4663, that there is a requirement that in the event you're going to change direction of your investigation, you have to come together as a commission and find, through a formal finding and meeting, that charges are reasonably related to a pre-existing charge. The facts of this case are gross. In 2006, Judge Jones was alleged to have been involved improperly or violated canons of conduct regarding a domestic violence issue. You may have all heard of it before, I was his defense counsel. 4 months later, that charge was dismissed by the Henderson Justice of the Court by, as a matter of law. It wasn't a matter of meet a standard of care or a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt by a directed vote at the conclusion of the state's case, the city's case, City of Henderson, the charges were dismissed. At that point, the JDC did not stop. They did not issue a decision saying there's no basis for going forward. We see it's been resolved. There's no evidence to suggest beyond or by clear and convincing evidence that a case can be made out. Instead, they keep the investigation open for 6 more years. It wasn't until July 10 of 2012 that a charge was brought against Judge Jones, where he was notified of those charges. And what do those charges say? On the front of the document, please note, our original complaint, which was based upon the executive director's complaint. The complaining party is the JDC's former executive director, and what does he base it upon? Newspaper articles of Judge Jones allegedly being involved in a domestic violence matter. And he brought the complaint, wasn't upon personal knowledge, and he cited the newspaper articles. And then, with the 4 months later, the judgment of acquittal, then he kept the investigation open, and then over the last few years, with the last event being 2008, the last alleged misconduct being of 2008, they then issue, 4 years later, this complaint on August 1 of 2010. So what do the rules require? The rules require, contrary to the position, that there is no due process rights to someone who is in this position. And I might want to say that Judge Jones wanted me, just came up here and wanted me to emphasize, it's not just for his protection that he seeks to have you grant this petition and dismiss these charges, but for every judge, including the seven of you, and every other sitting judge in Nevada, who must be afforded due process. In this Hall of Justice, how ironic is it that the JDC, who must be purer than the driven snow, who must protect the rights of all, that is their whole reason for existence, will now declare to you that none of the judges in the state have due process rights.
Mr. Jefferson, is there a distinction between the launching of an investigation and the formal complaint?
There is a distinction in that. That's true. But NRS 1.4663 requires that if you're going to change direction, if you see that your original charge is not valid, as in this case, and there's no ability to make out a case by clear and convincing evidence, that you must convene a meeting of the Judicial District Commission under 1.4663 sub 2 to make a determination, is what we are now newly investigating, quote, reasonably related, end of quote, to the prior investigation.
Mr. Jimerson, actually, one thing I'm interested in, I want Mr. Hutchins to address it too, trying to think of the logic of the situation. The amendment to NRS 1.4655 became effective in January of 2010.
Yes.
So if the commission knew or should have known of these previous offenses prior to January 1, 2010, can they say that it's not retroactive? I mean, wouldn't just the statute itself say that you really had a deadline of 1 year from that date to file the complaint? This time period, because the complaint wasn't filed for like 2.5 years after the effective date.
Exactly.
I don't have a feeling on one way or the other, but I just like each side to address that. I'm happy to logic, but otherwise, basically, if it only applied prospectively after January 1, 2010, like you said, any issue is open, it occurred before January 1, 2010 for anybody.
Absolutely. Under equal protection, the rational relationship test would preclude the JDC's view to be enforced because they would say that a complaint filed on 12/31/09 can go on for 20 years. But a complaint filed on January 1 of 2010 with enforcement rights could only go on for 18 to 24 months before the presumptive unreasonability of the charge. So to answer your question, we do not argue that the statute should be applied retroactively in terms of complaints before 1/1/10. We say that for complaints that were in existence prior to 1/1/10, they then had a new 18 to 24 month time period to bring to fruition their investigation. And that's the only interpretation that makes any sense, as Justice Goodman suggests, because at that point you have a couple of things. First, the prime executive director testified, and you have these minutes before the Senate committee with regard to this law. The law became the law effective 1/1/10, but it was passed with the legislature completing its work in late May of 2009. So there's another 7 months of notice that this is going to be coming on effective January 1, and then there's 30 months between 1/1/10 and July 10th of 2012. Before Mr. Judge Jones is notified of these charges. Clearly, it is unreasonable under these statutes, and clearly it is inappropriate for the JDC to suggest that even though it doesn't apply retroactively, we get a chance to have 20 years on something before 1/1/10.
Why should we retain this on a writ of mandamus instead of letting the proceedings run their course before the commission and then appealing those to us with a fully developed record so we could assess reasonableness and what's in play and what's not and so on?
Yes, thank you. In the Jones 2 decision, a three-person judge, justices, issued a decision on a 2-1 vote made up of Justice Chair, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Perry. And in that citation, in that case, and I have it before me, there is a specific statement by the three of them that when things are of moment, or significance, use the word unprecedented, when they're new, this is the use for the time of using a petition for writ of mandamus. They distinguished that from what they perceived was Jones 1, Jones 2, and the 2 to 1 vote by saying it was a matter of discovery. We don't see that as arising to the necessity of having to invoke ourselves now. So Chief Justice Pickering, my response is, when we look at the wholesale acknowledged departure from 1.4663 by the JDC, and why are they forced to make this decision? Because they have 20 years of moving away from 1.4663, 1.455. They couldn't say, for example, you know, we made a mistake. It was our inadvertence. We didn't mean to harm Judge Jones. They're forced to declare you had no due process rights during the investigative stage because somehow, some fashion, they've addressed these cases this way. And what's happened, essentially, when we look at the minutes, is there's been a wholesale abdication by the JDC membership to rely too heavily upon this executive director.
Mr. Jefferson, we don't often ask counsel to address whether they think the disposition of the case should be by published opinion. Is this a matter that should be a matter of a published opinion?
I was prepared to address that, Justice Harrison. The answer is absolutely yes. As we saw in the dissent by Justice Sherry, there are all too few precedents in this field. You have a series of Whitehead and you have a Mosley decision that you're familiar with, but this is an area of law that does need to be developed, and we would certainly request that to be, and that you'd make a determination that there are due process rights. But here's the key, in answer to Chief Justice Pickering's question, on an appeal, all too often, Justice Pickering, what you're going to be evaluating is, was the findings of liability appropriate? Was the sanction appropriate? Was it too hard, harsh, or too light? That doesn't address the issue of the JDC's failure to comply with their own mandates. The word shall is 34 times used in NRS 1.4. So while you may allow this gentleman the justice that he deserves after he's gone through the tumultuous and public matter of his trial, you have never addressed how he got it, because had they made, the one thing very clear here is that the loss of evidence in marijuana use, or an alleged allowing of someone you had a relationship with who appear in front of you, okay, or financial involvement involving a loan made by a relative, could not, as a matter of this court, as a matter of the law, be found by any one of the seven of you to be, quote, reasonably related to a domestic violent charge. And had that done, there would be no charge. My client wouldn't be here in front of you. And there's a simple remedy to this. What's the remedy? File a new complaint. Then you have contemporaneous evidence. You don't have the breadth of two witnesses that affect my client in this case. You don't have the loss of papers and documents. The solution is simple. If you find additional or new misconduct, file a new complaint. But don't hold it for 6 years to yourself. And you know, there's all kinds of issues about the president of Rukwai. Did he have an axe to grind before the executive director against Judge Jones? What's going on here? But you have a simple way to remedy it. So that is a long-winded way to say, Justice Arce, we do need your guidance. And I don't know, I'm allowed 2 minutes and 51 seconds. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
If you could address one issue, then...
Of course, sir.
Assembly Bill 496 expressly pronounces that the amendatory provisions of the Act apply only to a complaint filed on or after January 1, 2010, and B, a formal statement of charges filed with the Commission on or after January 1, 2010.
That is true.
How does that statute affect your statute of limitations argument here?
In my view, the statute, if it's left to that interpretation, is unconstitutional under the kind of the decisions of Moroni and of All Sins, Nevada Supreme Court decisions. Why? Because you then are treating irrationally, violating Judge Jones' 14th Amendment and state equal protection rights to allow complaints, a classification of complaints that predate January 1, to go on forever and be subject to the mischief of the JDC or its agents, as compared to, as you properly noted, Justice Arce, that you apply these rules going forward. This commission was on notice on January 1 of 2010, and certainly by May, because of the earlier testimony, several months earlier, that it would have 18 to 24 months, another 18 to 24 months, not to mention the 4 years that predated January 2010 to wrap this one case up or issue a new complaint. But instead, they withheld this and then didn't service. So my answer to you is the proper interpretation when considering a person's equal protection rights can only lead to the determination that the pre-existing complaint must then be handled in the same form or fashion as the ones that were initiated after January 1. Otherwise, the Constitution as applied, excuse me, the statute as applied to Judge Jones would be unconstitutional.
So I have a question if you would allow. I don't want to bring Mr. Jones' time. Let me just ask a question and then do that a few extra minutes after that.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, I believe I heard you say that you want us to extend due process. I didn't hear a delineation except in response to Justice Douglas's question about the investigation time period versus once the complaint has been filed. My concern is I don't believe that there is any other jurisdiction that extends that right during the investigative phase. Is that correct, or did I misread something?
No, you have not misread anything. If I use the word extend, that is the wrong verb. Okay, what I mean is to apply. That you apply 1.4663, 1.4855, and 1.481 to apply to the having due process rights during the investigative stage to anyone who is subject to a complaint, any jurors who is subject to a complaint.
But nonetheless, that would be the outlier in that area in the state of Nevada if we were to adopt such an approach.
No, because you already have it. You write the Nevada legislature mandate.
According to the rule, the statute.
And where does the JDC go get off not complying with statutes?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you.
Please add 2 minutes to both sides' clock. You have 2 minutes on the ballot.
Barely can say my name. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Brian Hutchins for the Judicial Discipline Commission. I'd like to start first with the basics, if I may, and that is with regard to the mandamus. The writ petition, of course, is for this court with issues that have not been presented to the tribunal below. And as this court knows, the writ's issued only if there's no plain, speedy, and adequate remedy. What's the status before the commission? There is no finding yet of sufficient evidence such that formal charges will be filed or a formal hearing held, both of which would be publicly done. The petitioner here has not presented his claims to the commission, just as a defendant in a civil claim or a prosecution would first present his claims to the court. Then to this court, the petitioner has made conclusory allegations of bias, improper procedure on the part of the commission, or prejudice to him. There have been no factual determinations at all made below. It's a very factually dependent argument that he's making before this court, and there is no record. The full commission and the proceedings and any appeal would be his adequate and speedy remedy. Instead of him wanting this court to be the trier of fact or to decide without facts determined. The commission's answer and its arguments in this case are premised on the considerations that this court issued in the Mosley decision in 2001. The writ is issued only when there's considerations of sound judicial economy and administration that militate in favor of granting relief.
I think we all want to know the answer of why it took 6 years. There's 82 district court judges, 25 senior judges, 7 Supreme Court justices, and 3 hopefully Court of Appeal judges that will come on board in 2015. Why 6 years for this investigation? I did a lot of criminal law, federal, state, death penalty cases, 6 years to investigate a judge. Why, Mr. Hutchins?
Justice Cherry, I also did a lot of cases as well, including death penalty cases, and they do take a long time, as you know. For me to answer would be for me to tell you what the facts are. The facts have not been established down below. That's something that does need to be established by the commission as to why. The answer is, for every question you ask why, there have to be factual determinations. They have not been made below by the commission at all. And in mandamus proceedings, as this court knows, it's usually on once a district court has made some kind of decision, maybe not the trial, but certainly motions to dismiss or other such things, and there have been determinations in the first instance by the court below. You've had no initial determinations by the commission in this case. There was no motion to dismiss filed by the petitioner. There was no assertions down below of facts, specific prejudice to him on delay. He simply says there's some lost evidence here, what he thinks is lost evidence, and some witnesses who are deceased, but he has not specifically connected those to any prejudice as far as the specific counts in the charges, nor has there been any rebuttal of factual determinations made by the commission below.
So what do you envision? Tell this court what you envision.
So I envision
the process to be now.
I envision, Justice Cherry, a remand to dismissal of the petition and let the proceedings continue. He can file his motions with the commission down below. Factual determinations can be made, and he can have his record that is presented to this court should he be prejudiced and be found that he's responsible for committing judicial misconduct.
Mr. Hutchins, could you clarify something for me? What exactly was filed with the commission on July 10th, 2012? It's characterized as a complaint, but that seems to be a word of art that applies rather to an assertion made to the commission staff of some judicial misconduct. What precisely was filed on July 10th?
July 10th of 2012?
Mm-hmm.
What date doesn't come to my mind? I'm sorry. I guess I need a more specific indication of the document that we're talking about here.
I'll ask Mr. Jimerson. He referred to it during his opening argument.
I believe there was a letter directed, if this is the one I'm thinking of, it was a letter directed by the executive director on behalf of the commission to the petitioner. And I
believe it's the proposed charging document.
Proposed charging.
I don't mean to cut you off.
I'm just about ready to go there, Madam Chief Justice. Thank you. But if it's a proposed charging document, I believe that's the document that was sent to petitioner by the executive director at that time, asking him at that point in time to answer that document. So the commission had to make the determination under Rule 12, procedural Rule 12, that that's the charges they were looking at, and it requires an answer by the judge before they can proceed to a determination, not a hearing, a determination as to whether there was reasonable cause for a formal hearing.
Under Assembly Bill 496, when addressing the language in the statute as to the effective date of the Assembly Bill, would the document you're referring to fit within either A or B?
Neither. The complaint was filed long before that, as the petitioner has alleged, and the complaint was not filed on or after January of 2010. Therefore, it does not apply at that point in time. If we're talking about statute of limitations period, and I know that that was Justice Gibbons' question as well, that statute is clearly not retroactive, and you pointed out in your question that Section 35 of AB 496 specifically said it was prospective only. The legislature has spoken. The legislature, by saying that, explicitly says that it doesn't apply to the cases before. The statutory construction phrase, the express mention of one thing excludes all others. I dare not try it in Latin, but that should apply as well. The legislature knows how to say when a statute of limitations applies and when it doesn't. This court, in the matter of Davis in 1997, also indicated that limitations periods are measures of public policy entirely subject to the will of the legislature. And as Justice Sada has pointed out, most states do not have a limitations period at all. So how there can be a constitutional violation with no limitations period is unknown to me.
I'm trying to clarify, Mr. Hutchins, if I may. Is the document that was sent by the executive director to Judge Jones and or his counsel the same thing as the formal statement of charges language referred to in subparagraph B of the statute?
In essence, it is that, a formal statement of charges. I'm sorry, if you mentioned A or B, and I didn't have those
exactly in my head as to what they said at the time.
I understand.
I believe A is the complaint, B is the charging document. So it would fit under B as a proposed charging document, which also goes to show that the commission is doing its job and saying that, well, some things have changed with that complaint, and you've got to make it different because some things don't apply anymore in that complaint, and you've got to let them know what's going on now.
So setting aside, let me ask you this. I had asked Mr. Jimerson whether he thought this statute of limitations and application of AB 496 should be the subject of a published opinion. What's the view of the commission on that point without reaching the factual questions that you're arguing?
That's the whole problem here because of all the myriad of factual determinations that need to be made. If there's going to be a formal opinion, it should be the nature of what mandamus requires at this particular stage in the Judicial Discipline Commission process. It should say, you've got to take your case, your factual assertions to the Court of Judicial Performance, which is the commission, mm-hmm. and have that Court of Judicial Performance make a determination of what the facts are and what the response is to your specific allegations.
But there does appear to be at least two legal questions surrounding the application of the statute. One is its retroactivity or not, and the second is whether it's burdened by equal protection or due process considerations.
But each of those, we contend, is factually dependent. In the brief, the answer of the commission on, I believe, page 12, as I recall, pointed out a number of the factual questions that are involved, even when you have a statute of limitations assertion, whether it applies to this particular petitioner. So until you can determine all those factual questions, you can't answer the legal question. You can't answer it.
So from your standpoint, this court should not even entertain the due process claim that's being asserted this morning.
Absolutely correct. Should not.
In the alternative, though there is a due process, do you think there is a due process issue?
No, we do not. We do not believe that because in a statute of limitations issue, in an equal protection argument, you've got judges situated differently. I think this court knows too that it amended the Code of Judicial Conduct in 2010. Does that mean that you can't do that because it'll apply differently to different judges at different times? Other procedural rules apply differently at different times as well. There's no first basis is there's no constitutional violation for a lack of statute of limitations. So then you have to look at whether they're situated similarly. They're not situated similarly if the complaint was filed prior to 2010.
So what is your vehicle that you believe Judge Jones should have pursued? You're saying this is not factually developed enough and on its face the proposed charging document is sufficient, but it does contain a lot of old allegations, 96, 97, 2003, 2004. How would a person in his position challenge the stale datedness, if you will, of those allegations, even assuming you're right and the new statute of limitations doesn't apply?
The appropriate procedure was to file a motion to dismiss, make his claims at that point in time, and have determinations made down below as to what the facts are and what they are not. And the commission can make that determination.
Including a motion that would say that charges that deviate from the original complaint relating to the alleged domestic violence or domestic issue should not be considered?
Yes, Justice Hardison, exactly. And what he's doing in before this court is making conclusory arguments saying, hey, look, take a look at the original complaint. Now take a look at the proposed charging document and compare those two. Hey, look, they don't match up. So automatically, there's a difference. But he didn't put into evidence the more than 320 exhibits, investigative reports, and so forth to let you look at those and see the progression from the complaint to the charging document.
Would you agree, Mr. Hutchins, that whether the subsequent allegations in the charging statement are related to the original complaint is an issue that exists under the law as she existed before January 1st, 2010.
I would agree.
Okay. And so the only reason this court, in your view, can't test that is because we don't have the underlying factual information to compare the two?
I believe that's the major reason you can't, that this court cannot do that.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that how you interpret reasonably related under the statute as she existed before January 1st, 2010 is an issue of law and fact?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hutchins, I had a question on that statute, and again, we interpret statutes all the time. I was thinking about the medical malpractice statutes, which have been constantly changed, and they were reduced to 1 year back when Coden passed in 2004 through the initiative. Here, you know, the statute, what would intrigue me in this statute, used 3 years before the date of the complaint, or 1 year after the complaint, should know the exercise of reasonable diligence, should have known the conduct, whichever was earlier. Now, earlier was a key word that bothered me. You know, if it's said later, you know, which sometimes are later, you know, criminal statute, you know, like sexual assault of minors, things like that. But earlier grabbed my attention, and it kind of dovetails into the argument Mr. Jimerson made. So using the word earlier, wouldn't the commission been on notice that as of January 1, 2010, when the statute of limitations was created by the legislature and became effective, that, gee, they had, if they knew or should have known, and I realize there may be a factual dispute about that, that they had a year to file the complaint, and then, like Mr. Jimerson said, maybe file subsequent complaints and all after that. Tell me what's wrong with that interpretation of the statute.
Mm-hmm. I think it's something that perhaps is giving deference to the judge in that particular situation. As you pointed out, statutes are usually the other way in a lot of cases. But again, it is, I don't know what else to say except that it's factually dependent on several things. Making you use the word reasonable, it's factually dependent.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I mean, I think there's any question it's factually dependent. I think Justice Hardison's point is, can we interpret the legal effect of the language of the statute, and assuming it's ambiguous, clarify the ambiguity? Can we do that now or not? Do we have to wait for the development of the factual record?
I think it's strongly advisable for the court to do that at this point in time because of all the outstanding factual issues. I think you just assume facts that are not in evidence. And I don't know that that's an appropriate thing for this court to do. I think if the court looks at all of the mandamus, its writs issued recently, they're all based upon some of the findings from the district court below, whether it's on legal questions or not. And in this case, there haven't even been determinations legally. So in the first instance, I think even the commission should address the legal aspect of that. You have two judges, two lawyers, three lay people on this commission. Let them do their job.
What's the schedule for Judge Jones right now, for your commission? What's the schedule?
Right now, the commission deferred to this court when it required an answer, and they have not been moving forward. I believe they should have moved forward, but they are waiting.
Didn't I do it? Now, again, I heard, maybe read an article or something in the paper. There was some hearing set in December of this year.
That's on a separate charge. These charges are, that's correct. They're nothing to do with this. And those are on a complaint that was filed after the statute went into effect, and those are proceeding. These are independent charges that occurred in a different light and are not proceeding. So they're two different things. Totally different.
This is a civil matter. Is Latches applicable?
I think in many respects, Latches is an argument, but as you know, Justice Sherry, that's factually dependent as well. And we pointed that out in the answer, and I will point out again in my reference to the answer, it's pages 16 to 18, about five different factual questions that we put in the answer as far as the statute of limitations or Latches. All of those questions have to be answered.
If we go along with you on your argument, what would be the procedure for Judge Jones and Mr. Jimerson to follow as far as testing the factual allegations so that our court can then review prior to a hearing?
Thank you. I think with any court, whether it be a court in a civil case or a criminal case down below, I think when you have to make your motion to dismiss, you have to attach the appropriate documents, the affidavits, and make specific allegations of prejudice and proof. There has to be the adversarial process with an answer and factual determinations ultimately made, and legal decisions also made in the first instance by the Judicial Discipline Commission down below. At that point in time, you can hope that he has a full record, and if he is prejudiced, meaning they found him responsible for judicial misconduct, he can have an appeal to this court, and this court would have a full record before it to make a determination. Things do take time. We do have processes, but this is the reason why. We have to have the factual determinations from this court. You can't do it on a blind record unless you're making determinations without facts. Let me just sum up, if I can. I'm sorry, Madam Chief Justice, I don't know how much time I have left.
You have a minute, Tom.
I don't.
But I'll give you a minute, and I'll add an extra minute to Mr. Jameson.
I think I've beat to death the fact that that the writ should not issue because there is a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy, and he has not satisfied his burden. That's his burden to produce the essential parts of the record. And I hope this court is not wondering about any of the other issues about the investigator's relationship to married to the wife of somebody working for the Judicial Discipline Commission. That was brought up in a dissent many years ago, and it was only the fact is that there is no bias. What if that relationship with cousins, in-laws, brother, sister, is it automatic because they happen to be married? But they're still both answering to the executive director. The executive director is in charge of the investigation, and not the investigator himself, the clerk of the Judicial Ethics Committee. That has no bearing in this case. The commission did manage its investigation, and those statutes and rules, if you look at them, they do not require a written determination by the commission. They require determinations, but they don't require written ones, and there's only one statute that requires written finding of fact and conclusions of law, and that's the one that requires the Commission on Judicial Conduct, on Judicial Discipline Commission, to file its findings of fact and conclusions of law at the end with the Nevada Supreme Court. Again, expressio unius, exclusivo ultras. I didn't say it right. I should have said it.
Okay, thank you.
I think you got the point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Jameson, please give him 3 minutes.
Think a minute about what the JDC's counsel says to you now. The remedy is not for Justice Hardesty, for Chief Justice Pickering, and all of you to insert your view now through granting this petition for writ of mandamus. The remedy should be a motion to dismiss a complaint before a body that is not following the law, before a body that has written a brief to defend itself to the allegations that we put in our petition. This is the even-handed body that Judge Jones is expected to place his fate in. Think about that. Think about the lack of rationale about that. Here we have undisputed, in terms of factual record, undisputed this. A violation of 1.4663 sub 1, if you find a violation, I certainly do, to use a familial relationship as an investigator. Would that not be an appearance of impropriety in the judicial canons if any one of you or myself as a lawyer would do such a thing? Number two, 1.4663 sub 2, the failure to meet and make a determination, it doesn't have to be in writing, it can be orally, but it needs to be reflected in minutes, meet to decide, do these new charges bear a rational or reasonable relationship to the pre-existing charge 5-6 years earlier? That we know never happened. That we know never happened. Why? Because what we have is the excuse and the answer to the petition that we filed is, when they approved here in June, July of 2012, the proposed charges, there's never been charges yet issued, but when we voted for the proposed charges that came out on July 10th, we impliedly made a determination that these charges are reasonably related to the domestic violence charges of 2006. That's due process. One of the things I wanted to answer to Justice Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, we agree that it is not a matter of extended rights. The statutes of 1.4 and the balance we've talked about are procedural due process rights. We're not asking for extension. Every state has procedures they expect their commission to follow. This commission is expected to follow, and that is what makes this case so egregious. To respond further to Justice Hardesty's point, the reason we need to issue mandamus is because you have a JDC that admits it is not following the law. It does not comply with 1.466(3), sub 1, 2, 4663, sub 4. There has to be a final report issued upon which the commission will then evaluate and then decide to issue proposed charges. There's never been submitted a prepared with final report. This is undisputed. And therefore, because there's been no final report, there's never been a decision upon a final report for which proposed charges. They issued these proposed charges without a final report. And lastly is the statute of limitations issue that we've discussed, 1.4655, in that you have an unreasonable activity on the part of this commission to wait 6 years. How will anyone defend themselves under the facts and circumstances of this case? And our interpretation, respectfully, is the only one that makes sense of the law to take into consideration the fact that you cannot treat disparately a complaint that's a day or a minute before 1/1 of 10 and have 20 years of process, in this case, 6+ years. And then knowing that that's a day later, you have to do it in 18 to 24 months. I really thank you very much. I know this is an important issue, and Judge Jones thanks you very much. But I tell you, please intercede to dismiss this complaint and issue some guidelines, because a JDC is not following the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This matter will be submitted and will be in recess until the next call of